And so the question that comes up, you know, when you read that letter is that, you know, why does Warren Buffett, who's got, you know, I don't know, 50, 60 billion of net worth, want to operate alone and with no analysts or associates? And then why does Charlie Munger want to do the same? And then there's a good friend of mine who's a value investor, Guy Spier. He operates the same way. In fact, he used to have an analyst till he figured out that that didn't make much sense, and it was actually you know, kind of causing him to have results that were somewhat negative from what he wanted. And so he went from no analyst to analyst back to no analyst, and I think he's quite happy now. And of course, you know, I operate alone, and so the question comes up, you know, as to why I would want to do that. And let's go to the next slide, Arvind. And so, you know, the issue in the investment business is that there are more than 50,000 publicly traded stocks around the world. And even if you have a 10-person investment team, you know, very smart folks who are in the team, they cannot actually look at more than a few hundred companies as a group together in a year. In fact, they'll probably get to less than that number. And so if you are an investment manager with this 10-person team that you're working with, who's doing a lot of the research for you, you would basically get reduced to, first of all, a lot of your time would go to manage the team, but also you'd be reduced to just getting a Cliff Notes version of the research these folks were doing. And on top of that, you would have secondary data. So you would not really have a full data set the way the primary people are doing the research have it. So, and let's go to the next slide, Arvind. And so basically, there's no way for an investment manager to be on top of thousands of businesses. That's just not possible with or without a team. And so really what the investment manager has to do, regardless of team size, is they have to take shortcuts because, you know, the data set is just too large. And the way they take shortcuts, there are many ways to take shortcuts. So, you know, for example, there's a mutual fund which is based in Minneapolis called the Mayors and Powers Fund. Some of you may have heard of it. And I think the charter of the Mayors and Powers Fund is to almost exclusively invest in companies based in Minneapolis. And so, you know, they've shrunken their universe of public companies to look at by having a mandate to only invest in Minnesota companies. There are other companies that will only invest in companies that are socially responsible. And certainly value investors sort of take all kinds of shortcuts. They might take shortcuts related to PEs or book values or you know, cash flow multiples and those sorts of things to try to narrow the universe down. And you know, there are you know, Buffett says that it is not the size of the circle of competence that you have that determines how well you do as an investment manager. It is knowing the boundaries of that circle really well that are really important. And so, you know, you don't need to know a whole lot about too many things to do quite well as an investor. So there's a good friend of Charlie Munger's, who's I think he's is or was in the Forbes 400, John Arriega, who lives near Stanford University. And all John does as an investor is he invests in real estate, which is you know, within a couple of miles or less of Stanford University. So his circle of competence is extremely small, you know, just real estate and just real estate around Stanford. And from a standing start, just doing that, he's a billionaire. And of course, you know, Charlie Munger says that if you wanted to get really rich and have a well-diversified portfolio, and you lived in, you know, Peoria, Illinois or something, what you could do is you could own part or all of the Ford dealership in Peoria. You could own the McDonald's franchise in Peoria. You could own the best apartment building in Peoria. And you could own the highest quality office building in Peoria. And if you had just those four assets, and if you just even own parts of those four assets, so you don't need to own them 100%, but you could have, let's say, a 10% stake in the McDonald's, for example. Then, and you never, you know, touch those assets, you just kept them. The odds are you would compound money at quite a spectacular rate and do quite well over time. And so, the bottom line is that in the investment business, you don't need to know everything about everything to figure out what are the best investments and such. And a large team is not as helpful as one might think to get you to the promised land. And so let's go to the next slide, Arvind. And, you know, so one of the things that happens is that when you have an analyst, you know, the chances are that you hired this person because you in some way like them as humans, and they are, you know, pleasant people to be around and such. And they hopefully are smart, you know, BC grads and such. And so, you know, when they come up with ideas, just the nature of the investment business is a lot of the ideas that someone thinks are great, you might think are not great. And so you'll say no, and you'll keep saying no most of the time. And sometimes you're saying no to ideas which actually may be good ideas. So any two humans are going to have differing circles of competence because their life experience is different. And what they've learned about the world and different businesses and such is different. And so someone could come to you, your analyst could come to you with a great idea. And because it doesn't fit into your circle of competence, you might say, well, that doesn't work for me. We can't do that. And in fact, this has happened to me. So for example, in I think in 2006 or 2007, when the first iPhone had come out, I have a really smart investor in my fund who's a venture capitalist in Silicon Valley. And he called me and he said, Monish, you know, you got to invest in Apple. And I told him very quickly that, you know, that's not happening because, you know, I don't do tech, I don't do businesses with rapid change and so on. And then he laid out for me, you know, why Apple made all the sense in the world to invest. And in fact, he, you know, he talked about the App Store. And in fact, he laid out what was likely to happen in a manner that was eerie, because what unfolded over the next several years was quite similar to what he had described to me, in the sense that they would, you know, transform mobile technology. They would transform just the way people, it wouldn't be a phone, it'd be a computer in your hand. And the App Store becomes a very high profit margin business for Apple with very little investment, and on and on. And of course, if I had bought Apple at the time, I think it's probably a 10x from when he was talking to me about it. And but I was right to say no, because it was indeed outside my circle of competence. And so if he were an analyst working for me, you know, he would be right in bringing the idea to me. I would be right in rejecting the idea. And, you know, he would rightfully be unhappy about it. And the same thing happened with, you know, Amazon. Some of my friends about 10 years ago were pushing Amazon because they just saw the way the company was transforming and everything. And again, it would have been a massive home run. And again, I said no. So circles of competence becomes one of the issues with having a team size greater than one. Let's go to the next slide. Then, you know, when you have a team, there's this natural bias for action. You know, like Warren says, the guys are going to say, swing, you bum, you know, why aren't you swinging? And if you have people who have high IQs, they're not really good at grinding away endlessly without seeing results. So, you know, some smart analyst keeps coming up to you with great ideas and you keep saying no. That's just a very difficult kind of situation to permanently be in. And just to give you kind of a real bit of data at Pabrai Funds, you know, in the last almost 17 months, we have had no new investment ideas, zero. And it's not because I haven't looked. I've spent lots of time looking for good investment ideas and such, but we've never gotten to the point where something made enough sense to pull the trigger. And so I just had to say no to myself. But you know, if I had analysts or partners, the natural institutional bias towards action would take over. You know, I think it'd be unlikely we would go through such a long period without acting on ideas. And you know, I've always thought kind of the best way to set up the job description for an analyst is to hire them and give them the ground rules. And the ground rules will be something like this, that look, I really don't want you to be in the office pretty much at all. I would like you to, you know, pick a beach that you like to hang out on or a ski hill that you like to be at. And you'll get your paycheck direct deposited into your account. And just hang out at that beach or whatever activity you like to do. And never ever call me with any investment ideas. And when I need help, you know, drilling down on a particular investment and need your brain power, I will call you. So, you know, you need to keep your cell phone around at all times. And when I call you, ideally you can call me back within 30 minutes. And drop what you're doing and go into full-time research and analysis mode on you know the help I'm asking for. And then when that's done, go back to the swimming or water skiing or skiing or whatever else you want to do. And again, you know, your paycheck's going to keep coming to your bank direct deposit till I call you with the next time I need you. And you can see that this sort of a job description, even though it sounds exciting, may not be that appealing to even most of you in this room. And so, you know, it's the difficulty in setting up a situation where a person is not constantly feeding you ideas and you're constantly saying no. That becomes kind of hard. And then, you know, the compensation problem becomes also kind of a bit difficult. So if someone brings me Amazon or Apple and in my, you know, moment of brilliance, I say no in 2007 or 2003, and then it's a 10x or 100x, and we missed that ride, and no one made that money. And so how do you compensate a person when things like that happen? And so can we go to the next slide, Arvind? And so, you know, one of the shortcuts I've taken, because again, the data set is so large, is instead of being like John Arriega and just doing Stanford real estate, I said, why not be a shameless cloner? You know, all I am is a low-life cloner, which we'll soon discover in all its glory. But basically, so. Long live the SEC and long live 13 Fs, which are the quarterly filings that institutional investors have to make. So one of the shortcuts I use quite a bit is I look at what the other great investors are buying. And so, you know, if I make a list of, let's say, 20 great investors, you know, Berkshire, Longleaf, Seth Klarman, Third Avenue, David Einhorn and on David Einhorn and so on. I have cut that universe of 50,000 stocks down to at the most a few dozen stocks. And if I especially look at what they bought in a given quarter, it might be down to, maybe a dozen stocks or less. So it's really narrowed that huge universe down to a much more narrow universe. And clearly, when people have made some, certain positions, their top holding or their top three holdings, some great mind has processed it and gone to the point of actually, investing large sums into that position. And so then I can look at it and say, do I want to do this or not? So if I see that, Berkshire Hathaway has taken a position in Exxon, which they just did, the good news is that Warren Buffett turned me down, but he doesn't realize that he's my analyst. And the best part is that he's my analyst at zero pay. And just like I told him, listen, just hang out in Omaha. And when I need you, I'll reach out to you. And usually I reach out to Warren on 4 days of the year. On May 14th, August 14th, November 14th, and February 14th. Those are the 4 days when Warren tells me what he's been up to. And so I can then look at what he's been up to. And what's even great about Warren is I don't even have to do direct deposit paychecks or anything. And he's never called to complain. And the other thing that's really great about him is that I keep saying no to all these things he comes up with, and he never seems to mind. And it's just wonderful. And then the same applies to like Ted Wechsler, who's also in Omaha hanging out, just like I told him to, and Todd Coombs. And then Seth Klarman hangs out in Boston with you guys. And so on, and then we've got the Longleaf guys in Memphis, and all these guys are hanging out, doing exactly what I told them to do, and 4 times a year, they pop their head and just quietly tell me what they've been up to, and then they go away, and they never get disappointed or dejected if I don't take them up. And in fact, as you can see, in the last 17 months, all these guys have come up with all sorts of things, and I've said no to everything, and amazingly, none of them ever mind. They're just fantastic humans. No emotional response to repeated rejections. It's fantastic. And so I have found that the payroll cost is zero, which is a nice number. I like that. And like the Miller commercial of some time back, not only does it taste great, it's also less filling. So it does both things at the same time.